Thanks very much. So thank you for inviting me, and some of my past has shown up. I was a postdoc here way back in 79 when the place was full of dog sleds and everything. John Wainwright was one of the profs here at University of Waterloo, so it's nice to see him. And this talk has a bit of history as well. I mean, this what I'm going to talk about primarily is the constraint equations and the conformal method for analyzing them. And the first work on this was way back in 1944. There's a beautiful paper, if you read a bit of French, by André Le Chenevich, where he was talking about the n-body problem, but it's really about the 3 plus 1 formulation. And probably the constraints had been written down before, but he emphasized them. And he also proposed a conformal method for dealing with them. It wasn't the full-blown conformal method, but a lot of the antecedents are there. Now, one of the things about the initial value problem that's important is if you choose, so what the initial value problem does is it takes the Einstein equations, the 10 of them, and it splits it into, and by the way, I'm going to, despite what happens in this building, I'm going to presume we're in 3 plus 1 dimensions. A lot of this stuff works in higher dimensions, but let's stick with 3 plus 1 dimensions. So you have 10 Einstein equations, and 4 of them are purely, if you're thinking in terms of an initial value formulation, they're purely constraints on choosing your initial data, just like in electromagnetism and Maxwell's theory, there are constraints on choosing E and B initially. So 4 of them are constraints, and 6 of them are evolution equations. But solving the constraints, finding solutions of the constraints, isn't enough to tell you that, in fact, that will generate a solution, a space-time solution of the Einstein equations. You want to know that the system is well posed. And that was the wonderful work of Yvonne Choquet-Bruha around 19, I don't know if it's 53 or 52, but there she proved the well-posedness of the Einstein equation. So if what she showed is if you choose initial data satisfying the constraints, there will exist a space-time, at least near the initial slice, if you will, which is a solution of the space-time equations. Then about 20 years later, in 1972, Jimmy York really got going on the constraints. This work on the initial value problem was out there, but not many people thought much about it. And still, so Le Chenevich's approach to dealing with the constraints again was out there, but not many people really did very much with it. And so around 72, 73, Jimmy York, among other things, extended the conformal method to work with all sets of initial data, and he also extended it to work with initial data for not just the Einstein vacuums equations, but Einstein Maxwell, Einstein fluid, and other things, along with some collaborators, including Neil O'Murhu. Around, again, another 20 years, so there was lots of, and that was also, I guess, when this so there was an emphasis on thinking about, besides just sort of setting up some of the mathematical means of analyzing the conformal method, he also emphasized this idea that we're working with conformal geometries, which are, as Julian will tell you, led eventually to the shape dynamics ideas. But around, so the conformal method was proposing a way to set up the constraints and try to solve them, as I'll illustrate in a few minutes. But it took another 20 years or so before one knew that at least in the case of constant mean curvature, that the conformal method pretty much was a good way to choose a certain set of data freely and then determine the rest of the data using the constraints. And there was also around the same time some progress on not just constant mean curvature, but near constant mean curvature. And again, I'm going to illustrate all these things in a few minutes. So at that point, I think everybody was pretty optimistic that the conformal method was going to conquer all, and pretty soon one would have pretty much could choose the initial data, choose some free information, and then use the conformal method to find solutions to the constraints, and then go ahead and evolve this stuff. And another 10 years later, Michael Holst did the first work on the what one might call far from CMC setup. Again, so it's not constant mean curvature, it's not nearly constant mean curvature, but far from constant mean curvature, and there was some progress. However, now I think it's fair to say that, depends on how pessimistic you want to be, but that going away from constant mean curvature, near constant mean curvature, all hopes are dashed. We don't really know what's going on. So if you believe in constant mean curvature or near constant mean curvature, everything works very well. But in the other cases, there's a lot of recent work, a lot of it by David Maxwell and Taekong Nguyen, that shows that there are a lot of problems. So what I want to do is go through these things systematically and show you, first of all, again, exactly what we mean by the conformal method, a little bit about some of the techniques we use to show that it generally works. In the constant mean curvature case, near constant mean curvature, and what we're finding, what is being found now in the far from CMC case. Now, again, there were comments yesterday about questions. I love questions. I don't have to get through this at all. I can talk. You know, I'll just go as far as you like. So please stop me with questions at any time if you wish. Okay. So you've all seen the constraints, but let me, just to establish notation to some extent, let me first of all, so for by an initial data set, let's presume we're working on some, and again, a lot of what I'm talking about will be on closed manifolds, but some will not be. We also talk about asymptotically Euclidean, asymptotically hyperbolic that we're learning a lot about. And there's even asymptotically conical that some people call trumpet data, I think. But anyway, lots of different possibilities. But let's take as the default, we have a three-dimensional manifold, and we're choosing a Riemannian metric that I like to write as gamma. And a symmetric tensor, K. And let's say that psi represents non-gravitational fields. And again, a lot of this stuff works very nicely for things like Einstein-Maxwell, for certain treatments of fluid. Notably, it has a lot of problems with the Einstein scalar field, and I'll get into that later. But let's just for now just think of this as generically generic non-gravitational stuff. And I don't know what you want to call, whether that's gravitational, non-gravitational, but we'll occasionally have a cosmological constant in there. And then the constraint equations, as you most of you know, scalar curvature minus kk plus the trace of k squared is equal to something that involves the non-gravitational fields, if they happen to be around, plus cosmological constant. And then one has the divergence of k minus the gradient of the trace of k is equal to something else that involves the non-gravitational fields. So again, if you can find gamma k psi, and now, by the way, of course, if you're dealing with something like Einstein-Maxwell, then there will be also the constraints associated with the other fields that may be around. Most of the analysis that I'm going to talk about, we're going to presume the non-gravitational fields are not there, just to make things simpler. But I'll emphasize later what happens with the scalar field. But let's say for electromagnetism, you can always stick that in. So again, the idea is if you can find gamma and k, possibly non-gravitational fields, which solve these equations, there will always exist locally a solution. Besides the local existence, you also get continuous dependence on initial data, which is very useful if you're interested in stability and perturbations. So one of the things that one might be interested in is the space of solutions. Space of solutions of the constraints. So you choose sigma 3. And when I say choose sigma 3, if it's closed, that's all you need to do. But if you're choosing sigma 3 to be open, then you say asymptotically Euclidean, asymptotically hyperbolic, whatever. And you specify the regularity. You specify if lambda is there. And then you can talk about the set of solutions of the constraints depending on, let's just say, on sigma 3. And one of the interesting things about this is that some very nice work of Fisher and Marsden and to some extent Moncrief years ago shows that this is actually, whether or not one knows how to specify this information, it's a stratified manifold. So it's a manifold, the space of solutions of the constraints is a manifold everywhere except at solutions which have some degree of isometry, which generate a space-time that has some isometry. So that was some very nice work. And in some sense, it's nice to think about the conformal method as a way of choosing coordinates, particularly now that we're finding that there are problems with extending it to everything. So since all, let's say that this is the set of constraints, and it's got these funny funny things here. But so in some sense, you can think of the conformal method as, let's say this is the constant mean curvature stuff. You're choosing a coordinate patch for it. So it's successful here. You don't expect it to extend everywhere. Maybe some other method might be needed. But in some sense, you can think of it again as a choice of local coordinates on the space of solutions. OK, so what is the conformal method for the constraints? Well, so the goal is to construct solutions and to explore mathematically what the space of solutions looks like. But so the idea is you want to choose the so-called seed data. And one can think of this as the conformal class. Conformal class of the Riemannian metric. So the actual solution of the constraints is going to be conformally related to this. And then one also chooses, according to the original conformal method, I'll talk about its cousins in a few minutes. This is sort of a conformal class of divergence-free trace-free symmetric tensors. By the way, there's a very nice, if you're into bundles, there's a very nice bundleology way of thinking about all this stuff in terms of properly quotienting out the conformal action here by David Maxwell a few years ago. If anybody's interested in the paper, I could give you a reference. I don't think it's published yet. And then there's also a function tau. And then the idea is to solve the conformal constraint equations which take the form of sort of a vector Laplacian. L on W is the conformal killing field, so we can think of it as a symmetrized gradient of this vector field W minus the trace minus something times the divergence of W. So it has, this is effectively a vector Laplacian on the vector field W. This thing is equal to phi to the 6th times the gradient of tau. And then one has the Laplacian. By the way, all these operators are with respect to the conformal metric that you've chosen. So this is Laplacian of phi is equal to the scalar curvature of phi minus sigma plus LW squared times phi to the minus 7 plus tau squared times phi to the 5th. Those of you who are familiar with these equations may wonder what happened to the 1/8 and the 1/12 and stuff, but I'm setting all such numbers to equal to 1. So I mean, it doesn't matter for what we're talking about here. So the point is, you chose this stuff freely. And there's a little bit of business about how do you find divergence-free, trace-free. But you know, that's just linear equations, as Jimmy York showed very nicely a few years ago. It's easy to find this stuff. So find the seed data and then solve this for scalar field phi and vector field W. And once you've done that, presuming you can, then you take gamma AB is phi to the 4th. Lambda AB and KCD is phi to the minus 2 times sigma plus LW plus phi to the 4th lambda AB times tau. And that's a solution. That's the idea. OK? So does the conformal method work? So having the conformal method work, I mean, ideally what one does is one chooses this stuff. And there's actually two aspects of it. There's choosing it generally, and there's also, if you're a physicist, and there's some around here, you want to choose it so it's actually going to model, you know, you're going to be able to use it to generate the space-time of interest. For example, two colliding black holes, you want to be able to choose this information so that, in fact, that's what you have, and not just any old colliding black holes, but the ones that you're particularly interested in. But the whole issue is, for such a choice, can you solve these equations and then generate this stuff? So ideally, one could always solve these equations, and there would be a unique solution. And if that were true, then you would have, in a sense, coordinates for this, because this free information is giving you the coordinates for the space of solutions of the constraints. Well, it's easy to see that it doesn't always work. By that I mean it's easy to find a set of seed data for which you can't solve these things. So let me just give you my favorite example is you choose, say, you choose sigma to be the three sphere, you choose lambda to be the round metric, the conformal class of round metrics, you choose the transverse traceless stuff to be zero, that's pretty divergence-free and trace-free, and you choose tau equal to one. And if you do that, I like all these boards. If you do that, this equation here just becomes that this vector Laplacian on W is zero. So effectively, so the solutions will be LW is equal to zero. So you can get that equation, and then you're just really focused on this equation, sometimes referred to as the Lichnerowicz equation. And so what happens with the choices that we made there? So what we get is, again, the divergence LW equals zero gives us LW equals zero, which gives us that the Lichnerowicz equation is just Laplacian of phi is equal to phi. And you can't solve that on a, and phi, of course, has to be positive. Otherwise, it's not a very good conformal factor. So you can't solve that equation. And it's easy to see that. You could be fancy and say it's the maximum principle, or just be a physicist and take the integral on both sides and see that you get zero on one side and you get something which is non-zero on the other side. So there are certainly cases where you can't, this stuff doesn't work. So the whole question becomes, let me put it over here.
Jim, sorry, one question. That data you've given, is it essentially point on conformal superspace without a direction?
I'm not sure I know what you mean by direction, but it's certainly...
Well, it's not moving anywhere else. It's not pointing to somewhere else in conformal superspace. You're starting on the round metric.
Okay. So
what it would be what I would call not a proper solution.
Okay, so
it's just a point.
That's right. Okay, so I'll invite.
There's no sensible evolution from a mere point.
Okay, so what I'm going to show you in a few minutes is for at least for the case of constant mean curvature, and let's say, well, actually, constant mean curvature asymptotically Euclidean, asymptotically hyperbolic, and closed. There are we can catalog exactly those sets for which there's no solution and those sets for which there are. And if you can identify all those in shape dynamics as something which has some perversity to it, then that would be great. That's all good, but what happens then eventually when we get to the far from CMC, we don't know what's going on. Okay. I mean, when I say we don't know what's going on, just as a preview, what we're going to find is there are nice sets of seed data for which if you can parameterize certain aspects of it, and if the parameter is small, then you get no solutions. If the parameter is medium, you get one solution. If the parameter is big, you get multiple solutions, and in fact, you can change the parameter in such a way that you get more or less an infinite class of solutions for the same seed data. So I don't know how that's the picture that's emerging lately. Of what happens once you get away from the CMC or near CMC. Okay, but again, I invite characterizations of the data where there are problems. So what was I saying? Yeah, question?
To some extent, that's what would be really a transceiver gene. It's vital. I mean, for us, where these things break down, our view would be that the space-time picture doesn't capture the physics of shape.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and again, if you're willing to stick with constant mean curvature, everything works fine until you get to until you add a scalar field, or for that matter, until you add a non-trivial, positive cosmologic constant. Then again, you have trouble. There's a lot of trouble there, too. So again, I know shape dynamics likes constant mean curvature, so a lot of the problems I'm going to talk about go away, or do not arise, but unless you want to put in a scalar field there. And scalar fields cause a lot of trouble. Full set of all those difficulties that I mentioned for the far from CMC. And in some sense, what it's doing is similar. I'll show you that a little bit. Okay? Yeah, so I know what I wanted to write down. So, I mean, what this game becomes is to determine. Yeah? Say again?
Do you count pressureless fluid or dust as a scalar field?
As long as you deal with fluids, you conformally transform them. In certain ways, it's no problem. If you conformally transform them in different ways, then it is a problem. So again, I'm not an expert on fluids. I was too tainted by Johnny Wheeler, who hated fluids and hated cosmological constants. So I thought, why would you ever consider that stuff? I know there's a cosmological constant, probably fluids around. Electromagnetic fields, that's what you work with. Anyway, if you scale the fluids in a particular way, then they're no problem. If you scale them in another way, then there is much problem in scalar fields. For the fluid fields. So again, the issue is to determine which seed data sets lead to solutions. So I want to mention some of these cousins. So we won't need these. And there's a whole parameterized set of these cousins, but I'll just mention a couple of them. So cousins of the conformal method . One of them is the conformal thin sandwich. And that's, I forget when, it was work of Jimmy York and some others. I don't remember exactly when it came out. But the idea there is to, the seed data, what you do instead of taking something which is divergence-free and trace-free, you just ask that it be trace-free. And you also pick another function which those who advocate this method insist on calling the lapse. It doesn't have to have anything to do with the evolution. It's just another function you can put in the seed data from my point of view. And then what happens is everywhere you see an LW, you put a 1 over 2 nu in there in these equations and wherever else you have it. And why do you bother to do this? It just looks like it's making it a bit more complicated. It has a very important property in that it allows this to be this whole system to be conformally covariant. What do I mean by that? The idea is if you take a set of seed data and abstractly, what you're doing here is you're choosing a conformal class. And again, David Maxwell has a nice way of writing, in a sense, the quotient out what you're choosing in this case. But in practice, what you actually do, and again, this is used all the time for these numerical simulations of black hole collisions, you actually choose a representative of the conformal class. And the issue is if you take seed data lambda, sigma tau. And what if you choose instead some other seed data, which is theta to the fourth lambda? So you're conformally transforming this and theta to the minus two, theta to the minus two sigma and tau. And then I guess with the nu, you'd have to do, what is it, theta? I think it's theta to the minus six nu. The issue is conformal covariance of the whole system says if you choose this data and you choose this data, a solution exists for this if and only if a solution exists for this for every choice of theta. And effectively, you get the same solutions as well. And this is a very nice property, which in the constant mean curvature case works nicely for the Lichnowsky equation by itself. But if you include this thing as well, then it doesn't work well in the usual conformal method. But in the conformal thin sandwich method, it does. And so you get this very nice property, which is very useful for the business of proving, of showing when solutions exist and when solutions don't exist. And again, David Maxwell likes to show, and he proves in a paper of a few years ago, that in fact, the conformal thin sandwich and the conformal method are effectively identical, even though from a practical sense, they're not.
So they perfectly match if you also choose divergence-free sigma.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a little bit of finagling here, and I'm not gonna go into it, but it perfectly matches, yeah.
But if you did think of
I've never seen that I've never seen that that's a useful thing to do. I mean, you could think about it that way, but.
Is it scaling the right way for that?
Okay. Well, I don't think it does, but. Yeah, I've never seen anybody pursue that. I guess I haven't checked. I mean, you could write out where does the, if you write out the metric, because so the metric is, the space-time metric is minus n squared dt squared plus gamma dx plus m dt, leaving out the indices. So this would transform. I mean, this is again, in the work of York, et cetera, he really likes this density transformed n. But I don't think that works. I mean, here you get a phi to the fourth. I don't know what happens here, and this is phi now. So I don't think it's giving you a space-time metric conformal transformation. Yeah. A question? Okay. So there's this method, which has, again, some very nice properties. And then there's another method that has been proposed recently, and this is the so-called drift method. Again, a cousin of the conformal method, and the idea here is to take tau, so usually one just picks tau as either a constant or as a function, but according to the drift method, instead what you do is you take, that looks exactly like white, you take tau and you split it up into some constant plus some other function, and you treat these things differently. And again, I don't want to go into the details of it, but the idea of this was to produce some method which would be able to handle these difficulties that arise when you have non-constant mean curvature. If you have constant mean curvature, then of course everything's just in tau naught, so it doesn't matter. Okay, so I should point out that both of these methods have enabled us to find some things that we didn't know about before. But including the drift method, but still there still are big problems. Okay, so let me now remind you of the what I call the classical results. I don't know why I'm using that. I always hated that because the Greeks had nothing to do with it. The Romans had nothing to do with it. But these are. I guess I could call these pre-millennial results. Maybe that sounds better. But this is when everything looked rosy and we all thought everything was going to work. So I hope I'm not insulting any millennials here. So, what these results show is that the conformal method works for constant mean curvature. And we're presuming that lambda is less than or equal to zero, and we could also throw in Maxwell properly dealt with fluids, and even some spinner fields, if one knows what that means to talk about classical spinner fields. Again, the key here is that because you have constant mean curvature, this term is zero, and so in the vacuum case, then LW is zero. But for example, if you're in the Einstein-Maxwell case, you might have an E cross B term here, where these are conformally. And it's okay to solve for LW. It's just the important thing that happens here is that the set of equations are decoupled. So this equation can be solved separately, and then you can focus all your attention on the Lichnevich equation. So so what happens then is when one has these tables I like to write, and since you may want to characterize some of these, I think it's important to show to write what these, when solutions exist and when they don't. So for the case of closed sigma 3, so in setting this up, it turns out that one of the useful tools for this whole analysis is the Imabi analysis. So one can show that, again, sticking with three dimensions, higher dimensions as well. In fact, I think Rick Shane and some others have new results which are arguing that Imabi works much more generally than was thought before. But anyway, so we'll split the metrics, the conformal classes, into Imabi plus, Imabi zero, and Imabi minus. And in the case of closed manifolds, that means can you conformally deform the metric to positive constant, to zero, or to negative constant. And then the other classification is sigma identically zero or not, and is tau zero or not. Because remember, tau is constant. So this class here sigma is identically zero, tau is equal to zero. Here, sigma is not identically zero. And let me emphasize that it could be zero somewhere, just not zero every single place.
Could you just imagine what sigma is?
Oh yeah, sigma was that seed data, the divergence-free tracery part. So think of it as the momentum conjugate to the conformal geometry. So I don't know how.
And I'm not interested in sigma zero.
Okay. Tau equals zero, and then sigma identically zero, tau not zero. And then finally, sigma not identically zero, tau not equal to zero. And this may be the class that you most, that you like the best. But anyway, so what you have is, so there's no solution here. There's solutions there. No solutions, solutions. Solutions there. No solutions, no solutions, solutions. None, none. Yes, yes. I put a star here because this is the only case in which their solutions are not unique. But the non-uniqueness here is pretty trivial. It's just the fact that this whole system devolves to Laplacian of phi is equal to zero on some compact manifold. So any constant works. And in some sense, all you're doing is rescaling the coordinates. So this is what one has for closed manifolds. For asymptotically Euclidean, it's more complicated and simpler at the same time. Asymptotically Euclidean, it's more complicated because the Imabi classes are considerably trickier. In fact, we don't know all that much about it. There's again some very nice work of David Maxwell and James Diltz on understanding these things. Among other things, the Imabi class here is exactly those which can be conformally deformed to be dead zero everywhere. But anyway.
Sorry, when you're defining the Imabi class for some time, the conformal transformations that you're allowing, Do they have some decay?
They have some decay. Yeah, so you have to, so all this stuff, I haven't talked about regularity here at all. Everything here, there's some conditions on regularity, and by regularity I mean how many derivatives you have and also what your fall-off conditions are. But that doesn't play a major role here. But yes, when the conformal transformations have to preserve the asymptotic Euclideanness of it. And in defining here, defining Imabi classes here, you can define them as to what metric can you conformally deform to a constant, but you can also define them by writing this particular integral, which you know is the lim super of something or other that I won't bother to write down. So, but that's equivalent to can you conformally deform. Here it's not. Here you write down those integrals again, so these classes are clearly defined by those integrals, but what that actually tells you about the conformal deformations of the metric is very, very different. I think we understand that a little better now from the work of Diltz and Maxwell. But anyway, apart from that complication, the rest of it's pretty simple. So sigma identically 0, tau equals 0, and then sigma not identically 0, tau equals 0. They're kind of boring as far as constant mean, because if it's got to be 0 asymptotically. So what you get here is yes, yes, no, no, no. No.
So just to remind us, the Imabi class is the Imabi positive, for example, is the class of metrics that can be transformed from everywhere positive scale.
No. That's true in the closed case, but in the asymptotically Euclidean case, I was telling you there's this weird thing that this is exactly the set of metrics which can be conformally transformed to scalar curvature dead zero. So it's quite a bit different here. One understands it mostly, but it's quite a bit different. These are clearly defined, but yeah, the fact is things work for Imabi positive. They don't work for Imabi 0 or Imabi negative. Yeah?
What's the difference between Imabi positive and Imabi
0? Well, I mean, by definition, you write out this integral, and either that integral is 0 or it's not. It's positive or negative or zero for that class. That's the defining characteristic. But then you can look at these things and study the properties. These guys happen to be those for which there's a conformal transformation, so the scalar curvature is dead zero everywhere. These, that won't be the case. So, and there's lots of other properties I could tell you about. They're a little bit mind-boggling if you're not used to it. But it's clearly defined. There's nothing strange going on. It's just a little bit counterintuitive. Like quantum mechanics. So everybody does quantum here, so like.
Here you put in sigma and tau, and if you had some matter,
yeah,
that would be included in the tau?
That would be in the sigma.
In the sigma.
Yeah, so sigma is, you know, so in electromagnetism, certainly, think of sigma and E squared plus B squared, conformal choice of electromagnetic fields, as the same thing. So in this thing, sigma identically 0 for Einstein-Maxwell means sigma 0 and E and B are both 0. And sigma not identically 0 means either sigma's not 0 somewhere or E and B are not 0 somewhere. That's the same class. So these, just think of it as sigma squared plus E squared plus B squared. Plus, and if you have fluids around, plus the energy density of the fluid.
Right. So the energy density all the energy density would be included in the.
Would be included in this class. Yeah.
Do you put restrictions on the matter fields, like energy?
Well, yeah. I mean, so again, from my Wheeler upbringing, usually stick with Maxwell field, with fields that we can write the things out, rather than saying all fields with energy conditions or something like that. If you work with fluids and you deal with energy conditions. But Maxwell, Einstein-Maxwell, you don't have to worry about that stuff. It comes for free with a statement of the field. And if you would ever be foolish enough to talk about Yang-Mills are identical to Maxwell's fields in this class. I mean, I don't know what classical Yang-Mills means, but anyway, you could write it out, and it would be exactly the same thing.
I thought they would scale differently than sigma.
They do. They scale differently, but their effect on the equation. So if you have Maxwell fields, what you get is a minus E squared plus B squared, phi to the minus 3. So in the equation, in the Lichnowsky equation, they scale different, but they have the same property in that there's a negative sign here and there's a negative sign there. And from the analysis of the Lichnowsky equation, which most of the I think, I think it's, I'm not going to have time to go through this, but the way one studies this thing most efficiently is from the sub and super solution method. From the sub and super solution method, this term is essentially the same as that term, has the same properties. The crucial thing is this guy, and this guy, and I should have put in the, if you have a cosmological constant, it's tau squared minus lambda, and then if you have a scalar field, you have minus whatever the, not phi, but let's call it psi, whatever the potential is for that. And that negative sign, this is what causes the havoc. This is what causes all the trouble. And you can think of if you don't have negative signs there, but you have a non-consuming curvature, effectively this gives you a negative sign in there because you can do some estimates like math guys like to do some estimates and tell you that LW is effectively phi to the sixth times stuff. And so if you then stick that in here, square the LW squared, it gives you some negative junk there. And that negative stuff is what causes all the trouble. That's what causes all the trouble. Okay. Let me just write one other case here just to finish the job. I like asymptotically hyperbolic as well. Partly I think those are important as well. This would be data which is going to squi, if you're looking at initial data sets which are approaching squi in some sense, or if you have some interdecit or whatever. But what happens in this case, asymptotically hyperbolic, then in this case, there's only Yamabe negative, so that makes that easy. And then you have sigma identically zero, and tau equal to minus one. That's one class, and the other is sigma not identically zero, and tau equal to, what can we get? How about minus one? That's all you allowed. And all you allowed is negative Yamabe. So this guy's pretty easy, and you get a yes there, and you get a yes there. So one of the things that we've done recently, just to sort of clean up some of the loose ends, is there some considerations in dealing with asymptotically hyperbolic data, which are called the shear free conditions. And it appears from work of Piotr Krushel, Vince Moncrief, and others, maybe it was even known earlier, that if you have asymptotically hyperbolic data and you want to generate a space-time from them, at least a space-time to the future, you have to satisfy these so-called shear free conditions. And what we've shown recently is that all fits in nicely with the conformal method, so everything works nicely in that case.
Just to be clear, when you say yes and no, for instance, when you say no, it's that you can't prove it for...
It's not that we can't prove it. It's what we...
Or that it doesn't exist at all.
What it says... that's important to be clear. What it says is if you choose any seed data with Yamabe zero and with sigma not identically zero and tau equals zero, there ain't no solutions. Not just there's you can't find a solution, not that just I can't prove anything. There ain't none. There's absolutely none. So in this... for these classes... Now we know in some sense exactly what the conformal data is, exactly what the seed data is. We know when for which stuff solutions exist and for which stuff solutions don't. So we are, I'd like to think, we are really getting for this manifold of all solutions of the of all solutions, we're getting a nice coordinate patch here. So we have a 1-1 bijective map from data we understand to solutions of the constraints in that region. Okay? So so this all works nicely. What do I have? I have about 15 minutes. This all works nicely for constant mean curvature. And again, I understand shape dynamics, that's what you're interested in. So the picture is I think, quite pretty in this. I could fill in what kind of regularity conditions as well. For near
CM. Pardon me, I'm not trying to understand what you're reading. So let's just take the four manifold, just topological for a moment, forget the outside field.
Four manifold or three manifold?
Four manifold.
And
and your S3 is fully embeddable as a sub manifold. So is the claim that, and again, just forget the untangled equation, but just think about the space, family of Lorentz metrics on this four manifold. Is the claim that there is no Lorentz metric such that the restriction to that three manifold has that seed data? Or is the claim that there is a Lorentz metric, it's just that
No, there won't. There will not be seed data which has that form. Yeah, this is a bijective thing.
Okay.
So there will not be seed data which fits in any of these classes.
So there is no rent spectrum, whether it's or not.
Yeah, there will be no seed data with consuming curvature. Again, this is all for consuming curvature.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and okay. Any other? Okay. Yeah. So for let me just say something about near CMC. Again, I don't know if this is of much interest to shape dynamics, but it works nicely for this business of trying to classify solutions. So the thing about...
Sorry, he said all Lorentz metrics?
Solutions of Einstein's equations. Einstein's equations are crucial here.
I'm saying ignore Einstein's equation, which is... math problem,
all Lorentz. So that's wrong. So if you just put, I was being stupid. If you just put a Lorentz metric on it, you're sure you can do that.
Okay, good.
So Einstein's equations are crucial here.
Okay, good.
Yeah, right. And for those of you, I forgot to mention, for those of you who are interested in how you prove this, let me just say that for the nose, it's very, very easy. All you do is, it's basically this maximum principle. You choose data of this sort, and everything devolves to the Leishner-Everish equation, and in those classes, you have the conformal covariance, so you can set the scalar curvature equal to plus 1, 0, or minus 1, and then in all those cases where it's no, this thing will have a sign, and you can't solve this, you can't solve these equations. You have to have the battling signs, or it doesn't, or you can't find solutions. So that's the case here as well. The yeses, some of them are easy, but some of them you have to do a bit more work. And again, I think the most efficient method for handling this is the so-called sub and super solution method, which I'd be happy to talk to people about if they have any interest. The near CMC, what does one mean by that? Very roughly speaking, I mean, it depends on the particular case, but very roughly speaking, one is saying that the gradient of tau over tau is sufficiently small. And again, in some cases, if tau has zeros, you have to be a little more careful, and it might be what small means. But the important thing about this is that if we make that assumption, then what happens here is what it's telling you is that whereas LW is not zero, depends on phi in some sense, it doesn't upset the equilibrium of the sign of this thing being positive, effectively. So to actually prove that solutions exist takes a lot of analysis, but that's really what's going on. None of the signs are bothered, so your sub and super solution methods effectively work. You have to, again, use sort of sequential stuff. But anyway, it can work. So essentially, these charts work for the near CMC as well. And I could write them down, but I don't think I'll bother. OK, so what's happened more recently? I'm running low on time, so I won't go into these new shear-free results. But I guess I should mention the conformal killing field issue. Some of the results in particular, actually, conformal killing fields don't bother you at all if you stick with constant mean curvature. But even in the near CMC case, it plays a role. And in that case, it turns out that only using the drift method can one prove that the results that are effectively like those charts are hold even if you have a conformal killing field. Conformal killing field can cause trouble. So what? Let me just say a little bit about what happens in the case of far from CMC or far from CNC or even CMC with with scalar. I should, when I say scalar fields, should say with the potential of the scalar field being positive, or with cosmological constants. So effectively, again, what happens is those terms affect the sign of this thing. So the proofs of existence don't work. And that might just tell you, well, you know, how many times does a mathematician prove that they can't, that they're incapable of proving certain results? That's not very interesting. But what has developed in the last 4 or 5 years is that one now has, there's special cases. Where one has parameterized sets of seed data, where let me just give you one example, where one has let's say that one fixes the Imabi class, and one has the a norm of sigma, and one has the average of tau divided by the oscillations. And what one finds here in this particular case is there is one solution over here. There's more than one solution here. And then one has no solutions. And one has greater than or equal to two solute. Yeah, this is greater than or equal to one and greater than or equal to two. So this is just sort of a graph where one is graphing the magnitudes of the seed data. So again, remember over here, either sigma is dead zero or it's not. You don't have to worry about what its magnitude is. And of course, oscillations and the like don't matter. So we're just graphing this stuff. And one can show that in certain ranges here, there's no solutions. Other ranges, there's multiple solutions. So in this particular case, one has sort of graphic one can see a bit of what's going on, but this is a special case, and it doesn't lead to insight to other cases. And this is, again, for far from CMC, but even if one sticks with CMC and restricts oneself to and considers scalar fields, then you get, again, some results very much like this. So it's not clear what's going on. And again, this drift method was invented as a way perhaps to get around that, but the numerical investigations so far show that it's got trouble too.
So these oscillations of tau, you could also replace that by some mean on the scalar field.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, the scalar field. Not so much. Just the presence of the scalar field causes trouble, even with a cause. I mean, so there's some very nice results of Piotr Kuschel and I'm forgetting the other guy, but where it just puts in a cosmological constant. So it's not so much the oscillations; it's just getting the sign on this term wrong. So what this term becomes, as I think I was writing before, is tau squared minus something that effectively so you have the scalar potential of the scalar field you might have. And you have cosmological constant, and you also have effectively gradient of tau squared. So all these things times this phi to the fifth term. So anything that gives you negative here, not negative there, causes trouble, or generally negative, So it's the oscillations of tau that cause trouble, or just the presence of the scalar field. Again, if it were a massless scalar field with no scalar potential, then that's perfectly okay. That works exactly like Einstein-Maxwell, no problem. Cosmological constant, which is negative, fine, no issue. It's positive cosmological constant that causes trouble. You know, if you want to nitpick, you could say, well, as long as I keep tau bigger than lambda, then you're okay. But that's, again, I would argue that's nitpicking.
But my question is whether if this fails at some point, for example, if the scalar field makes this negative only at a couple of points because the scalar field.
Trouble. I'm guessing trouble. But one doesn't have a general picture. All that's happened so far is particular cases have been looked at. I mean, it's not easy to do this stuff. Particular cases have been looked at, and this has been what one has seen. So and there's bifurcation theory, which is arguing, again, some of this work of Kuschel and others is arguing that you have, in some cases, infinite set of solutions of these things. You might say, well, what's wrong with infinite sets of solutions? That gives me an infinite, you know, so I get lots of solutions of the constraints. Maybe that's a good thing. But if you're interested in actually parameterizing this set of solutions and thinking about this as, I mean, in some sense, the old York idea, and I think this has come through in shape dynamics, is to somehow think of the whole thing, the whole the dynamics of the gravitational field as being on some conformal superspace of some sort. This is saying that, you know, that's problematic. Again, this is purely for Einstein's equations and the like. Let me just say in 2 minutes, I mean, there's another totally different way of handling the constraints. It doesn't give you a parameterization, a set of coordinates for the space of solutions of the constraints. But another way of constructing solutions of the constraints is gluing methods, and the gluing methods have been working very nicely. I mean, there's so gluing. Just quickly, the idea there's it's basically the idea is to somehow take pairs of solutions, or even more, and of solutions of the constraints, and find new solutions of the constraints which have both of them in there. So the one version of it that some of us have done is, say, there's a solution of the constraints on this manifold over here, there's a solution of the constraints on this manifold over here, and you pick a point you like over there. And what you can do is find a new solution which, outside of a neighborhood of that point, is exactly the same as the ones you had before and is connected and is a smooth solution of the constraints everywhere, connected by some. Or you could even choose a point there and point there. Say you're bored with not having a wormhole nearby, so you can stick a wormhole. Well, it's hard to take your initial data and actually stick the wormhole in there, but there is a set of initial data which is identical to yours, which has a wormhole connecting this point and the point outside the door of the Perimeter Institute, so you can get in without having the right accreditation. So this is one version of, yeah? No, absolutely not. Vacuum.
I did vacuum.
Yeah. I didn't tell you how long this thing is going to last. It might be 10 to the minus 80 seconds that this thing before this thing blows up and kills everybody in sight. But it will exist. Okay. Yeah. So what you're referring to is probably Thorne and all those guys say, in order to keep a wormhole there long enough so you can make a movie where you go through the wormhole, then you need various funny fields, but funny conditions. But I'm just saying for the initial data. So there's this result, and then there's this the Corvino-Shane results, which are very nice.
If the wormholes appear, you have the volume change, and the theorem by Broca says that you have the violet energy.
No, because this just says you would have another space-time that has that thing. Oh, I mean, when the thing blows up, well, the space-time's dead when it's blowing up, yeah. So Garrosh tells you have to keep the same topology. Yeah, in the domain of dependence, you keep the same topology. When that thing blows up, space-time's gone, or at least unless you can go through the singularity somehow, which I hear people talk about. There's two other versions of gluing that I know of due to Shane and collaborators. One of them says take an arbitrary blob of stuff, which is asymptotically Euclidean, and say you're very set on having exactly this solution inside this sphere, then there will exist a solution of the constraints which is exactly the same as the one you want and outside some sphere whose distance may be very big. That's a little bit off center. But outside here, it'll be identically curved. Completely smooth, identical to this inside here, and identical to curve outside there. So there's that. And then this other method.
How much is curved? Like,
an infinite amount of it.
Or could you go inside the.
No. Well, no, it's just going to be exterior curve. Exterior curve. Yeah.
And the mass of the curve would match, or the
is of the curve arbitrarily match. Close to what it was to the original stuff. Yeah. Then there's this other stuff that says maybe you don't want a neighborhood like that, but maybe you just want to make sure that you have some sort of a cone that goes out to infinity, and this is not a space-time cone, but a cone in the initial data. So what it says is that there will, so you have identical in here, and there will be another cone outside here, such that it's identical in here. It's not Kerr out there. It's Minkowski, and the mass is essentially the same. So what you've done is, and inside there's this transition region. That's where, as Cliff Tobbs likes to say, that's where the dead horses are buried. So all, who knows what's going on in there, except it's controlled. It's controlled, so the dead horses don't smell too much. The total integral that gives you the mass of this thing, you have the same old contribution from here. You have absolutely no contribution from out there, but there's enough stuff in here to give you this, essentially the same mass. So these gluing methods, again, I don't know how they would relate to shape dynamics or the like, but they allow you to construct. I mean, among other things, one thing you can do is say you want to set up initial data for an n-body problem. So you have, and by initial data for an n-body problem, say you want to have you want to have 13 solutions, and the first one you want to have mass this and angular momentum that, and velocity that. You set this thing all up the way you want. I can tell you how to use these gluing methods to find an initial data set which has exactly those things that you want. The one problem that this method has, and this can actually be done both from the method I talked about here, which we developed, and using chain collada this way. The one problem that our method has that I was pleased to hear is not so much of an issue for some of you guys is we can set this thing up with exactly the masses and angular momenta velocities we want, but the scale, we can't control the scale. So they might have to be, we can say we want it to be an equilateral triangle, but the scale might be bigger than one might have expected. The scale is not under control. So I can, you tell me what kind of n bodies you want, and I'll give you initial data which has those, but possibly scaled in a way that we hadn't expected. So I think I'll close with that. Thank you for listening.
So can I ask one question before I... So can you say something about interesting solutions that cannot be captured, right? Or physically interesting solutions? Is there some knowledge about physically interesting solutions that cannot be captured by CNC?
Physically interesting, that's a loaded word.
Globally hyperbolic. And
yeah, so one of the things we were able to do with the gluing is construct a set of data which Erdley and Witt told us would generate a space-time which has no CMC slices. So the idea is, I'll give you the simplest version. Yeah, I think this is a very interesting open problem that particularly if you're interested in CMC is important. So the way you construct this data is you say you choose data on a torus, or almost anything except a sphere. So you have some initial data, and then you find another copy of it here, except it's identical. So this one you have gamma and k vacuum, and here you take gamma minus k. And it's easy to see that if you just flip the sign on k, it doesn't change, it's still a solution. So if I have a solution here, I have a solution here. And then what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to pick a point there, I'm going to do this gluing. And I'm going to do the gluing in such a way that there is a so this is a S2 cross interval. So there's an S2 in here such that the data is gamma is reflection symmetric and K is reflection anti-symmetric across the center. Okay, so gluing shows that you can do that. And what one can argue then is that the space-time development of this initial data will not admit any constant mean curvature hypersurfaces. How do you show that? You show that because say there is one up here with tau equal 37, Well, it's easy to show that then there has to be something down here with tau equal minus 37. But then you can use some nice results of, I forget who proved this stuff, Gerhard Bartnik, et cetera. I don't remember exactly. But if you know that you have constant mean curvature 37, constant mean curvature minus 37, then there has to be a slice which has constant mean curvature, any number between these things. In fact, you know, their results say if you have constant mean curvature greater than 37, constant mean curvature less than minus 37, every other value has to be achieved in here. But you know there can't be one where tau is equal to zero because this topology will not allow a tau equals, will not allow maximal data. It's easy to look at the constraints and see there's no such solution. So that argues that there are no solutions, that such a solution, which is a perfectly reasonable solution, has no constant mean curvature slice in it. So then what you ask, so you have a whole bunch of these things, and there are various results of Bartnik and Brill and some other people where do it asymptotically Euclidean or do it with matter in it, same kind of thing holds. The very interesting thing is this just an anomaly? Is this just a set of measure zero in the space of all solutions, or is it generic, or is it something in the middle? We don't know that. You would have thought, since we actually know how to construct initial data, which has this property, why not perturb it a little bit? Well, the mathematical argument, we don't have an implicit function theorem that says if we perturb a little bit of the hypothesis, the argument still goes. It doesn't work that way. So that fails. And I think it's a very interesting wide open problem. Are there other ways of constructing initial data for which the space-time development has no constant mean curvature slice? Are there other ways? Is this actually a stable property of this data? One doesn't know. And that's very interesting from the point of view of the business of looking at spacetimes, which with shape dynamics, often you presume that there's some constant mean curvature
but
guy there.
But all the classical exact solutions of Einstein's equations would have something like that, at least outside the horizon.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Well, except, yeah, I mean, if they're globally hyperbolic, Gödel has nothing. But yeah.
Years ago, Bertoff and I developed a method to create Machian theories using something called best matching. In 2005, Neil and I and three other people put out a paper which needs to be re-looked at again because I don't think it's quite right. But you apply these best matching ideas to create a Machian theory of curves on conformal superspace, a closed pair, where a point and a direction, basically, or a point and a tangent, actually, was in that case, determines a solution uniquely.
Mm-hmm.
That leads to vacuum Einstein general relativity, and if the mathematics is right, it leads at the same time to the constant mean curvature method for solving the solutions and the Laplace fixing equation.
Okay.
All comes out of one package. Just straight application.
Okay.
Machian idea.
Well,
I'm immensely encouraged by what you're saying about all the positive things about CMC.
It
just selects a tiny selection of the general lot of general solutions of general relativity.
It's just this is sort of the bug from the point of view of somebody who works with general relativity. This is still the bug in the CMC game. In fact, when I first gave a talk on this at my university, I called the talk job fraud, because when I gave my job talk at University of Oregon, I gave a talk which presumed that there were CMC foliations of every spacetime around. So I was wrong. So, but whether this is just a funny special case or not, I mean, CMC, there's a lot of nice things about CMC. In fact, there's a very nice new paper by John Lott, where he, in a sense, does a lot of the geometrization that you can do with Ricci flow using Einstein flow, not all of it by any means, but a lot of it, using, again, CMC foliations. And some of these studies of, you brought up this velocity-dominated stuff, Belinsky, Kolotnikov, Lifshitz. A lot of the nice ways now of studying these things, again, use CMC foliations. And so one is working with an elliptic hyperbolic system of looking at the evolution. So CMC is very, very important. I would like to resolve this issue, and I don't know how to do it.
I didn't quite understand that one. If you could just say what is it What is that? Are you saying there's a solution of general relativity which...
I'm saying there's a globally hyperbolic solution of general relativity which admits absolutely no constant mean curvature slice.
Yeah, well, I would just say general relativity is not the correct theory.
Fine.
The correct theory is all of, happens to be all of those general solutions for a closed space.
If I go along with it, if I would go along with that, then I would like to know. And so that's perfectly reasonable. You might say I have chosen for one of my selection devices, physicists do this all the time, a selection device for good theories, good solutions of the theory is has to have a CMC foliation. Then I want to know which solutions fit into that category and which don't. So I would claim this issue, regardless, you know, is important to determine what solutions you're filling
up. That general relativity was not found by pure Machian methods, but was found by an indirect and very brilliant method of Einstein. And
yes.
if the correct Machian derivation had been found first, nobody would have dreamt of looking at all the solutions of GR.
That's right. And again, good old Johnny Wheeler would, you know, I like to interpret what he was doing as saying, we're going to use Mach as a selection device for solutions of Einstein's equations, throw out solutions which don't have constant, which don't have, not spatially compact. Throw out solutions. He didn't like T3 because that had various funny properties. Throw out these guys. So you could use that as a selection device, and I think that. But you know,
it's not a selection device. It's saying this is the correct theory.
Okay.
And Einstein is the wrong.
Okay.
Theory.
Yeah. Well, you know, as long as my paycheck comes from the math department, I still have to, you know, phrase it in terms of
let's
theorems.
Let's take Jimmy Daniels.